I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, the psychology of hate. Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley join us. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hi, Mindy.
I guess we should start with what hatred is. I guess it can be directed at individuals, groups, entities, objects, behaviors, ideas. So where does this come from? And is it usually based on some kind of fear?
I think that's a fair statement, yes. Definitely some kind of fear and or some kind of injury or fear of a future injury, which again is fear. That really is what hate, it's a protective mechanism, defense mechanism to protect us from hurt in any kind of way, physical or psychological, emotional, some kind of diminution in our power or sense of security, all those kind of things. Being in that situation or fearing that situation is a hurtful thing. And much of our psychology is designed to deal with hurt, to protect us and minimize any kind of experience of hurt. It's natural. It comes from survival. Hurt means injury, means threat to survival. So it's a very basic, primitive kind of emotion that has been supported by evolution over millions of years. So we can't, don't think we can eradicate it.
It's well, not I guess something the disagreements start early.
Okay,
in this
go
program.
Ahead.
I think I would say hate is really a cognition, not an emotion. I think it's a misattribution of a conglomeration of the emotions that Mark mentioned, fear, anxiety, a cognition, a belief that is of the uncertainty of the future. And I think our brain, after a while, labels this as a hatred. Oh, I just can't stand that person.
Right.
And some of the indication of this, oh, I just can't stand Brussels sprouts. I can't stand, rain or something like that. So that's really a cognitive attribution trying to make sense of some of the emotions that we are having inside ourselves. So I would not consider hate an emotion. I think it's improperly labeled. But I can see why people would call it an emotion because it's based on all the emotions that
yeah.
Mark so you certainly if feel it. You feel
yeah,
it.
Because
I was looking at that, as I was looking up this, had some people called it an emotion, some people called it a feeling. And then I was like, okay, so what's the difference between a feeling and an emotion? Aren't they the same thing?
Well, properly speaking, they're the same thing. There are people who are researchers who want to make a fine line discrimination. But right. When I talk to people, I just talk about feelings and emotions being the same thing.
Pretty much the same thing, yeah. I think a feeling might refer a little bit more to a bodily sensation as part of the experience.
Well, that's interesting, because when I talk to my patients, I differentiate, and I use exactly that example. We have, in our country for generations, incorrectly trained ourselves and trained our students, taught our students that a feeling is everything in the world. So if you go to a physician, you go to, guy because you have a sore throat, he says, so, Joey, how are you feeling today? He's clearly talking about a physical sensation.
Yes.
You come to a guy like me or Mark and we say, so how are you feeling? We're clearly talking about emotion, happy, sad, mad, glad. And if you go to a business meeting and say, well, you've got the proposal in front of you, so what do you think? And Joey says, well, I don't feel this proposal really has hit the mark. He's talking clearly about a cognition.
Right.
So one of the earliest things I do with the work I do with people is to get them to differentiate among those three different cognitions, physical sensations, and emotions. Because once you do that and give yourself the wrong vocabulary, you're way off. The compass is leading you way astray, and that just builds on each other. So it's important to have some kind of identifiable vocabulary that people agree on, and the word feeling
covers it all. Yeah,
ain't
that's interesting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but our conscious experience is really a blend of all three, and that's what we're aware of is that blend, and it's useful to tease out the parts to kind of understand what our conscious experience is all about.
Yeah.
Right, and I think a lot of the hatefulness in groups is based on a non-conscious experience.
Yes.
Clearly, it seems to me that it's clear that the leaders are basing their leadership on manipulation, on a conscious experience. But I think a lot of people have what we talk about, like a visceral response.
That's
right. They misattribute it. Well, no one bothers to go in like me and Mark and say, well, let's try and unpackage this and see where that cognition is coming from. The leaders will just manipulate them and try and stir the crowd up, the so-called rabble-rousers of the French Revolution.
Exactly.
They will just try and manipulate that without trying to educate people about that. And that's one of the things you want to do is you want to educate people. You want people to not have higher and better education. You want them not to be educated because they'll be able to uncover the charlatans, and the charlatans don't want that. They'll be able to better challenge their government, and the government doesn't want that, no matter what the government is, whether it's a local government or a cult. They, they don't want people to do that.
That's why radical Islam is against education.
I was surprised. The Southern Poverty Law Center currently tracking 1,600 extremist groups in the U.S. 917 of those are considered hate groups, which kind of gets you thinking, okay, well, who are all of these people, and why would somebody join a hate group, and do they see themselves as haters? There's a few questions in there, I know, but I was even stopping to think myself, okay, hate is to me, it's a really strong word, a strong whatever, feeling, emotion. And I thought, okay, what do I hate? And I couldn't think of anything. I couldn't think of a person I hate or a vegetable I hate. I mean, I guess I hate war. I mean, but, you know, but there are some people who hate a lot of things. Mm-hmm. So where does that come from? Is that people, somebody with a lot of pain? You know, where does that come from?
Well, one of the traps I think we fall into when we talk about this is we lump everything together. So we have 15 people and they self-identify, or we identify them as hater in a hate group. But in reality, you get people there who may have a personality disorder, some people who are depressed, some people are anxious, some people have ADHD, some people have PTSD. So these people are normally distributed to the population. There's not one unitary reason why. But if I were to put my hat on something, I say they people have an enduring trait of that, and it can be developed in someone, trained into someone. I would say that really is a personality disorder, a person who is unwilling or unable to change their mind, even though they have reasons presented why they could change their mind. They just refuse to change their mind. Not that they don't know that they could change their mind. They just, adamantly refuse. I think that has to be an ingrained kind of trait, and I think it's probably been a personality disorder issue, generally speaking.
I would say so, too. I would agree with that. It's a need they have to have a certain cognitive view of the other groups or the other people that are the objects of their hatred. They really need to hold on to that and will tenaciously in spite of other exposures, other examples, and in spite of being exposed for being hypocrites.
Also gives them a sense of identity. You know, if I hate Joey or Billy, that makes me better than them, or it doesn't make me like them, and they're an independent, or they're Democrat, or they're a black, or they're a Mexican, or they're whatever. We always tend to ostracize an outgroup as a way of tending to make ourselves feel better. And again, it's education that helps people realize those aren't reasons. You know, if you feel better about someone just because you're different from them, that says something about you. It doesn't say anything really about them. It's something going on inside your psychological makeup.
Exactly. You have power over them, and they can be – you can have identified them as a threat. Whether they are or not doesn't matter. That's your experience. They are threatening.
Right. You can manufacture yourself as having power when in reality there's no change whatsoever.
That's right. Yeah.
So when you look at some of these hate groups, if you ask them, are you a hate group? Some of them will say, no, we're not. We don't hate anybody, right? I mean, other people on the outside looking in would say, well, wait a minute.
We love the whites, for instance. We love our race. It's not that we hate others. We just feel that we are better and we need to preserve our culture. And it can only be preserved in an orderly fashion if we're on top.
Right. And that's not you, Mark Spanking. That's the
groups. Yes, right.
So there, I think that falls in the category of cognitive bias, is really a thinking bias that people tend to have. One is called a blind spot bias, which means that you see the perceived problems in other people, but you never see them in yours, in your own self. So you don't see your own biases, you see others. And as far back as the 1800s with Freud and a guy named Charcot in France who were doing experiments on hypnosis and psychology and psychopathy, he developed a term that he called scotomization, which is referring to the medical term of having a blind spot in your eye. And he'd identified that as being a term for the psychological blocking of unwanted perception. So if a perception is coming your way and you don't want to notice it, you just make yourself blind to it. You just refuse to see it. You know, something like, I guess, an aggrandized example might be left neglect. Where the left side of your body is there, but after you have a stroke on, you can't see it, which
is fascinating that the brain is able to.
Right, so there are some people who deliberately block out any kind of perception. They don't want to be They don't want to be bothered by it. No, I don't want to see it. Yeah. But it's not even that conscious. They just will look right at it, and it's not there for them.
It's not there. Yeah. Actually, really I found a reference that goes back earlier than the 1800s to 1600.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Sir Francis Bacon wrote about it.
Ah.
I don't think he didn't label it specifically motivated reasoning, but that's what he was describing. Mm-hmm. He says here, the human understanding, when it once was adopted an opinion, draws all things else to support it and agree with it. Though there might be a greater number and weight of instances to be found on the other side, yet these it either neglects or despises, or else by some other distinction sets aside and rejects, providing the matter to a great and pernicious extent in order that its former conclusion may remain inviolate. Mm. So he's saying, in nice language.
Yeah, he's saying the same thing.
He's saying the same thing, but that's in the 1600s, and that was early 1600s, and that was the dawn of the scientific era at that time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the observation has been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
The idea about motivated reasoning is really important. You know, if I have a reason to deny something, if I have a reason to pretend something, well, then you have to say that I'm probably deliberately lying about something because I'm motivated to like not see the truth and something like that. Different from someone who is inadvertently wrong about something. And again, someone who deliberately has that enduring trait, I think, would be in the category of most likely a personality disorder, not just
error. Think you have to remove the word deliberate because there's no deliberation about it.
Yeah.
It's just an automatic a sense and an automatic expression.
Right, that would be different from personality. But personality disorder, I think, could be identified by someone who refuses to change irrespective of any kind of evidence. But someone who just is following the evidence and there's erroneous evidence, you can't blame them for coming to a conclusion that people misinterpret data all the time.
Right.
Sometimes they spin the data.
Right,
research that is funded by ABC Corporation magically seems to come out to support ABC Corporation's product. How does that happen? Well, we just know it does happen all the time.
Sure.
So,
And when you have some people like looking from the outside in on some of these groups, and you think, how are these people following, like, these leaders of, whatever these hate groups are? I mean, because it doesn't, in a lot of ways, you go, how can you not see that this is that what you're doing, this is a hate group? Is it just they, like you're saying, this is what their belief is, and so they're following this leader saying, okay, he's speaking the truth, and all this other stuff out here is not truth?
Well, I would invite people to get into the heads of the people. We all saw the images in Charleston of those neo-Nazis marching in with their torches and their slogans. Try to get into their heads. What is making them do that? We look at that and say, how can you possibly behave like that? How can you possibly believe these things? They do it sincerely.
Mm-hmm.
They hold on to it sincerely. And part of the sincere belief has to do with a social bond, to the group. They certainly have identified with that group, and the more outspoken they can be, each individual can be, and the more, in some ways, flagrantly, dramatically hateful, then they get more status in the group. So that's one factor, but I would invite the listeners here, if they can tease out and shed a little bit more light here on what goes on in their heads that they gather together and behave in this fashion. Fascinating task.
Well, I would. I think that Mark is giving a good example of what I'll call the educated person fallacy.
Mm.
People who have a totally different mindset, they always think about, why is that happening? Let's try and figure out why that's happening.
Yeah.
I really think that's a waste of time. Because the only reason I say that is because understanding the reasons why something happens do not give you the opportunity to change them. So if I understand I'm an alcoholic, okay, so what?
Mm-hmm.
The important thing is how do I stop being that, not why I became that. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So, and if you try to figure out, gee, why are these people so different from me? How is it possible that they don't think the same way I do? The fact is they're never going to think the same way you do, and trying to figure out why and trying to get in their heads will only aggravate them.
Yeah.
And probably make things dangerous for you. So I don't think having a lot of education, while clearly folks like me and Mark value that, A majority of people, I don't think, do.
Okay, I'm going to disagree a little here.
Yeah, okay.
I'm thinking, as Mark was talking about this, I was thinking about gang violence.
Yep.
And you go, how can these kids do this stuff? You know, and how, you know, and for a lot of them, it is that sense of family. A lot of them, you know, they come from, you know, whatever homes, they're not stable homes.
Right.
And they get recruited in, sometimes forcefully recruited in.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that, so you know how these kids get into this system, into, can't you prevent that early on by you know, whatever programs you might, through the schools or through the neighborhoods, you know, create something that gives them that whatever that void that's being filled by the gang, fill that some other way, you are preventing.
Well, I would say that comes into the how category I'm talking about. The why would be more like, let's say, an individual child.
Mm-hmm.
His individual circumstances, Joey's individual circumstances, why he joined the gang, different from Billy's and Sally's. But the how is still the same. Let's give them different life experiences that they had, and that'll remove the reason that they need to have that kind of group identity.
Right.
So the why would be different for each and every person. You could have 50 or 60 different whys, and that doesn't
inform.
Okay, that's all I'm saying.
But, yeah, and the experiences that you provide hopefully will give them a sense, an opportunity to have a sense of identity, a sense of success, really, at something.
Right, but that would apply only to Mitty's gang example, the hate group, the mm-hmm. white supremacists who were down in Charlottesville. They came from all different walks of life. And the example I'm going to use, just for example out there, people who are listening, are the Juggaloos that the FBI wants to say is a gang member.
Mm-hmm.
These are followers of the rock group Insane Clown Posse,
mm-hmm.
a rock duo. And they always talk about their sense of family, 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 family. And there's a very small percentage of them who identify as juggalos. I'd also do crime, but the vast majority do not do that kind of stuff. And so they've been branded by that. But the whole sense of having family is really important to people, and we create our own families. You know,
mm-hmm.
the media can be seen as a family. A person in a political group, the Republicans, Democrats, Congress, senators, they're all, you know, families. We call them tribes, I guess, or some
right.
of guilds, but they're all the same kind of thing. So having a kind of group identity is very important, and people can merge the group identities. People remember several different groups. I could be a government worker and still join a white supremacy party, and I could join a different kind of a party. I can do a line dancing kind of party because I have multiple kinds of aspects that I'm responding to, but every single one of them, I'm joining these groups in a way to try and fulfill a need that I have inside myself that I am not consciously aware of.
Mm.
That's the issue.
Yeah, we're driven that way.
Right.
We're driven for, and it's the reason for the progress of our species is
mm-hmm.
Social bonding,
mm-hmm.
and it's the reason for our survival. We are a species that needs others, as opposed to turtles or reptiles.
Right, which is a good thing. But
right.
with a manipulative leader who understands that,
right.
they will try and harness that and control people and manipulate them. So you get an unscrupulous salesperson who knows how people hardwire, and they will try and manipulate you to buy their product that you don't need or charge you too much money. And because everything else seems fine, you say, okay, sure, I'll go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
So in an unscrupulous person, a sociopath or a psychopath, they can manipulate those normally occurring kind of healthy traits
right.
and spin them and distort them.
Exactly.
And that's what people have to be aware of.
Yeah.
Yes, and that's what the research shows about people in hate groups. They have been identified as having a what they call a dark triad of
mm-hmm.
personality traits. Machiavellianism is one, which means
yep.
manipulation. Psychopathy, which is the other one, which has to do with breaking rules and not caring. And then narcissism. Those
mm-hmm.
three traits
mm-hmm.
Have been identified in hate group members to a much higher degree than in the general population.
And when we talk about traits, we talk about enduring personality, not just
right.
Like I'm depressed for a few
mm-hmm.
weeks or anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
right.
enduring.
Yeah, right. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to join the conversation. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of hate with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. We'd love to hear from you what your thoughts are. 866-999-4626. Or if you have a question, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I mentioned the number of groups, extremist groups, 1,600 that the Southern Poverty Law Center is following, 917 considered hate groups. That's just in this country. Of course, there's a lot more
yeah.
worldwide.
There's 12 in Massachusetts.
Yeah, 12 in Massachusetts. Thank you for that.
Any here on Cape Cod?
We don't know.
Not specifically.
They didn't break it down that way, did they?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I guess would be would be, you know, good for recruiting for these groups is the impact. So what's the internet? What's the internet impact on all of this?
Well, one of the biggest impact, probably the biggest impact on the internet, and I'll use the internet globally, but I'm specifically talking about Facebook and Google, is the fact that, let's contrast that with the newspaper. If I want to put an ad in the Boston Globe, I reach, I guess, everyone in the Boston Globe, right? Everyone sees the same ad. But if I put an ad on Facebook or Google, I can specifically target. I can say, Mark, I've got the great product for you and it's only $13. I can target Mindy, and you'll never see the ad I sent to Mark. Say, Mindy, I've got a great product for you. It's $4,978, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're responding to individual ads. No one ever sees what the person is saying to everyone else, so there's no way to check the veracity.
Oh, sure.
And there was...
Russia took advantage of that. We're learning now.
Yeah. It's okay. Mm-hmm. So that's what the whole idea of the internet is. And even on something like Snapchat or Instagram, if you have a group sharing kind of chat, everyone can see what everyone else is posting. But if you make something private or you only let certain people in, you can be a member, again, as Mark and I talked about, two or three different groups, tailoring your message to that particular kind of group. And they'll think, hey, that guy's one of us, mm-hmm. when in reality, that guy is a phony and that guy is trying to be one of several groups. That is the biggest impact that the internet has made, individualized messages down to the individual person, sure. to an individual day.
Right.
So
that's
if
right.
You know that someone is having a hard day because wow. of an algorithm, you can tailor a message to them on a really bad day. And if you want to sell a product to them on a really good day, the algorithms permit you to sell something on a really good day.
Sure.
That is a big difference.
In terms of the internet, I think it just has blossomed hate groups. Mm-hmm. And they're growing, and we're going to see more of it. And the internet is instrumental. It's really central. What it does is it gives an individual an ability to type a few words and feel a sense of power. That then is read, and somebody might identify with it psychologically mm-hmm. that they might have not been inclined to do otherwise, but might have a bad day. They might feel particularly threatened, and they jump in and start expressing themselves, and that's how the germ spreads.
And that's what I'm sorry, I just want to say that's what Google does with the algorithms. They've changed, so they only send you the things that, that you have looked at mm-hmm. before. They don't send you anything new. That's a confirmation bias that they're sending you, which is. That is deadly. That is absolutely the wrong way. Yeah. Everyone's got their own newspaper on the internet, all full of confirmation bias.
Yeah, and I was going to say the way people talk to each other on the internet. You know, somebody posts something that seems perfectly innocent, and you've got all these, you know, people come in and criticize, and others will, you know, come back and say, you know, leave that person alone. I mean, it goes back mm-hmm. and forth into this craziness. And in real life, if these people were standing in a room, that wouldn't happen.
Absolutely
wouldn't
not.
Happen.
No,
yeah.
no.
And also,
no.
when people talk to each other with their friends, they use a lot of coarse language, and it means nothing because you're talking to your friends, right? Yeah. But people will say over and over again, there's some things you just cannot text to someone because it doesn't come out the same kind of way, and it's totally misunderstood.
Right.
Misunderstanding is the source of all difficulty.
Yeah. Right. Let's talk to Stephen, who's giving us a call from Chatham. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. I was listening to what one of your guests said about the different types of hate, maybe the vocabulary needs to be cleared up.
Yeah.
Like hating Brussels sprouts, I'm sure the Brussels sprouts don't take it personally,
yep.
but
yep.
there's
yep.
frustration, high disappointment, but it seems that a lot of people are using hate to cover a lot of that. You know, fed up with the status quo doesn't mean you hate that stuff. And I actually looked on the Southern Poverty Law.
You said you hate that stuff, Stephen?
Define hate, and there's no definition there. Mm. There's no criteria how they rank people, or, you know, so you're either on the hate list or you're not. You know, and so it's like, where do they, who appointed them the experts? That's my frustration.
Well, they do. They do have a definition, though, Stephen. And their definition of a hate group includes any group with beliefs or practices that attack or malign an entire class of people, particularly when the characteristics being maligned are immutable. That's what we have from the printout.
Okay, then they must have added that recently. I looked some time ago, so I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah,
but it needs to be cleared up.
Yeah.
Thank you, Stephen. Thanks for the phone call. Mm-hmm. 866-999-4626 is our number. If you'd like to chime in, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Last month, our topic was denial, but denial kind of plays into the topic this month as well.
Right. It's such a rich topic, Mark, and I didn't get a chance to really get into it. We just scratched the surface. But I would consider denial to be a form of hate speech, and I wanted to classify that two different kinds of way. There's a disbelief about something because of not knowing, and then there's a what I will call an institutionalized, deliberate kind of disbelief about something that a person just refuses to believe anything about that's different than what they want to believe. And I think that's really a form of hate speech. And like Mark talked about Bacon, Francis Bacon in the 1600s, there's a report in the 1700s that Thomas Jefferson commented on this to a colleague at one of the Continental Congresses when one of the representatives was going on and on and on. And Jefferson was asked, don't you want to stand up and refute everything he's saying? And Jefferson looked at him and said, to refute him is easy, but to silence him is impossible. So people have recognized this in other people's, you know, for a very, very long time. So denial can be a form of hate speech because you're refusing to deny, for example, a victimization or refusing to deny the reality. In fact, in some legal circles, there's something called DARVO when it refers to perpetrators. It's very typical for perpetrators to example something called DARVO. They deny any abuse that they're responsible for. Then they attack the victim who's trying to hold them accountable for what they did, kind of like a whistleblower or people who's trying to hold a perpetrator accountable. And then the perpetrator starts to reverse the victim role, making the victim the one who's offended, right? And this can be used to describe any kind of threatening behavior. Mark and I would talk about sociopaths and psychopaths, but it's also used in some legal areas, the DARVO. That's what perpetrators try to do. And anyone who's been paying attention past, 7 or 8 months, may notice the same kind of behavior in certain areas of our country about people who use that exact same kind of stuff anytime someone says something that they just disagree with. You know, sure. There's no kind of discourse
actually,
on that.
It reminds me, O.J. Simpson and his lawyers, team of lawyers, perfected this and got him off using this very same technique, making him the victim.
We get that a lot of time. You see, even on TV shows, you see someone yelling, I'm the victim here, and when they're the person who's accused of being the perpetrator. So I think denial used like that is very, very malicious, and it's it has a lot of reasons why people engage in that Mark and I talked about, but I think at base, it's hate speech and part of an underlying personality disorder when someone refuses to change despite any kind of evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. Our president is like that, unfortunately.
Right.
Let's talk about hate. I mean, I think we talked earlier. I mean, a lot of it comes maybe from your environment. I'm just thinking, somebody who are we born to hate? I mean, you mentioned it is a natural, but why do some people hate more than others? I mean, what?
Oh, that has to do. I think there might be some biological aspects of it. You know, hate runs in families. Probably,
it does.
I can say.
Oh, I don't think it's. You think it's genetic? I don't think.
Well, I think there could be a genetic predisposition that is only turned on in certain families, certain experiences.
Because I think, like bullying, a lot of times the kid who's the bully is being bullied himself.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Well, it's mostly the experience, but I wouldn't deny biology here at all.
I don't think I'm in the same camp with Mark on that. I think people are trained to hate. They're trained to be a bully. Sometimes you fall into these things by accident, you know, that's for sure.
But you also might have a disposition that might incline you to a little bit
more. I think you're on the right track there. I think you'd have a disposition to maybe being a little bit more reactive.
That's right.
A disposition to some underlying psychological process that manifests itself, and it's easier for someone to become a hater or a bully. I think there's some sensitivity. You have a biological sensitivity to become extremely sensitive and cry a lot. Well, a lot of guys, for example, don't they're socialized to not cry, but to get angry.
Yes.
Women, it seems okay. You can cry as much as you want. You're socialized to do that. Everyone thinks it's fine. A guy does that. Oh, his life is over, you know. So
that's right.
Certainly, given the choice, a guy is going to become a bully. He's not going to become a little crybaby because everyone's just, you know, he'll be crucified on the playground.
Exactly. And then there's some biological roots to that. Some biological aspect. That's all I'm
referring to. I would agree with that, yeah.
What about dehumanization? I mean, that's something that a lot of hate groups use?
Absolutely. And we need to be very conscious of this process, dehumanization. There's one recent study of the alt-right where the researcher advertised on the internet for people in the alt-right to volunteer to do some psychological testing. And then, of course, he got a group of people that were not associated with the alt-right. The alt-right, by the way, is an extreme ideology of the right, but it's extreme, and it especially is around supports white supremacy.
Would that be the same as what they used to call ultra-conservative, or is that a different?
Well, no, because it's more of a racial thing. That the white race is threatened.
Got it. Okay.
And we have to. We're under attack. We're the victims, is what they're saying, and we have to counterattack in order to preserve.
Right. That'd be an example of the DARVO.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Synonym that I'm talking
about. Yeah. Exactly. So that's what the alt-right was, or is. Mm-hmm. And it's a relatively recent grouping, I would say. At any rate, the psychologists or sociologists recruited these people, gave them some psychological tests, and tried to determine then what distinguishes the alt-righters from others. Well, one psychological test had to do with the belief about evolution and how evolved races are. And we've all seen the diagram of the ascent of man, where there's on the right, there's a man walking, and then before him is there's men that are a bit crunched over, smaller, all the way down to the ape, who is walking more or less on three legs. And so they asked these people to rate 0 to 100 on a humanity scale. How human or how humanly evolved are the various groups? And the various groups were the things that we group people in, blacks, Hispanics, Muslims, Italians, any kind of racial grouping, Jews. And what they found was with the alt-righters, they consistently dehumanized, in other words, saw groups that are different from them as less human than the people who were not in the alt-right. Mm-hmm. And the numbers are kind of interesting. On average, they rated Muslims as a 55, again, out of 100. Democrats at a 64. Black people at a 64. Mexicans at a 67. Journalists at a 58.
Jews, used car salesmen in there.
They didn't mention that. Jews at 73 and feminists at 57. These are all enemies of the alt-right, obviously, these groupings. Whereas people who were not part of this ideology rated all these groups kind of in the 80s and 90s. There was no real differentiation or consistency. But the point is, this is just a measure of illustrating how psychologically the alt-right individuals dehumanize the people that they are against or feel threatened by. Mm-hmm. Dehumanization is a psychological tool that allows people to be violent against one another. Because if you can't be violent if you really kind of empathize with another person as a human. You have to turn off the empathy. If you have a sense that they're less than human or less human than you, you can be violent. You can kill animals to eat them, for instance. Part of our survival.
You can also put them in jail and in solitary confinement.
Absolutely.
Right, so I will take the hit for that with the pitchforks and torches after that. But yes, we have the same problem in our prison system.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
With prison. And the difficulty is some guards will tell you that the prisoners seem to be less than human.
Yep.
And even if that started out inadvertently, prisoners being treated that way actually become less than human and treat the guards as badly as the guards report being treated. And the guards have no alternative but to try and defend themselves, protect themselves, which perpetuates the cycle of the dehumanization, even if it started out innocently enough to, protect society from very dangerous people.
Exactly.
But as Mark is saying, dehumanization is the very first step people need to do as to give themselves permission to eradicate an entire race.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Genocide is that, and it's use it in war.
I was thinking the military.
Military have to
dehumanize. You can't have empathy for the enemy.
You can't
right?
have exactly. empathy for right. the enemy and still shoot at them and try to attack them. And that's the slippery slope of human destruction, really.
Well, also we have that in sports. You can't really be very nice to your opponent if you're going to want to beat them at a sports or not in boxing, football, something like that. And even on the street, if we have a lot of people, when they run into someone who has a different point of view, they will not take the time to try and understand the point of view or even try and educate them to their own point of view. They'll just dismiss them. Oh, that person's a jerk. Oh, that person, he's not worth your time. Yep. So we tend to dehumanize people almost as a I'm with Mark on this. It seems to be a biological function, perhaps, of self-preservation to keep ourselves distant from someone, and we have to become aware of that and overcome, because that's a confirmatory bias that we have.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of hate with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So you mentioned sports before we went to the break, and it made me think of this whole Yankee-Red Sox rivalry. And there's a lot of, I don't know if I call it, but certainly passion there on both sides. And I can tell you, a few years ago, my husband got a lawnmower from my brother who lives in Connecticut that had a Yankee sticker on it. And he brought it to somebody local here to fix. And the guy said, don't even take it off the truck. Nope. It's got a forget it. Nope. And he's like, trying to tell me he's not a Yankees fan. But but yeah, I mean, but let's talk a little bit about individual hate. We've been talking a lot about hate groups, but what about individual hate?
Yeah, that is, it's certainly related, and people can think of their bosses, perhaps, that they hate, hate your job, or hate other coworkers, etc. It's a personal experience. The thing that would be enlightening when you are in that is to ask, how did I hurt the person that hates me? How did I hurt their ego or their sense of themselves? What is there about me that the other person feels threatened by, or feels that I've taken away from? That looking at hate there as a response to injury, so that if you ask yourself, why is this person treating me this way, as if he hates me? Ask, what is there about me that threatens him, or what is there about me that I took from him? Mm-hmm. Sometimes it can be jealousy.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe you've done nothing.
Maybe even absolutely done nothing, but you're perceived as having done something. Typically, the situation would be a boss is threatened by the knowledge and competency of a given employee. Mm-hmm. That's why they hate them. That's why they're giving them such
a hard time.
It's
pretty hard, though, to sit down with your boss and say, why do you hate me? You know, I mean,
yes, you can, and that's an option, but certainly start it with yourself in your own head. So at least you get some understanding of what's going on, and you don't have to then be so reactive to the provocations that the boss is.
Well, I've got a story about doing that with your boss that I might have told before. Boss hired a psychologist to come in and do a sensitivity training and awareness raising in the staff. And during one of the breaks, one of the staff members found himself in the elevator with the aforementioned boss, and he said to him, "I always thought you were an NSOB, real son of a gun." And the boss said, "You're fired." And what he was going to say is that, "But now I realize that you're a pretty good guy. I was wrong about that," but too late, he was fired.
Yeah. So you got to be careful, yeah.
Yeah, you may have the best intentions, sure, but the other person, won't be able to.
Well, they have the power in reality.
They might not be able to accept that.
Yeah. All right, so what is hyperbolic discounting?
Well, yes, my guess is there's probably a lot of hyperbolic discounters out there, so listen up. Basically, that's a term that was developed by a behavioral economist to talk about what psychologists talk about in terms of immediate payback and delayed gratification. So one of the reasons that people have a cognitive bias against processing new information and changing their mind about something is hyperbolic discounting. That's a tendency to prefer an immediate payoff versus a later payoff. So if I have to think about stuff and process stuff and try and come up with a new idea or a new way of thinking, that takes too much time. That takes too much effort. I want something right now. And, I'll just sort of stay with the thought that I have. Right. That also is involved with people when they're doing purchases. That's what a lot of stores will have. You have a big store. They have merchandise on an end cap that's really cheap. Mm-hmm. And you go in the store and you decide to spend more money on stuff that could be cheaper someplace else because I don't want to drive to the other store. I'm going to stay here. So a cognitive bias we have about staying the way we are and doing what we're doing is hyperbolic discounting. Yeah. And that's very common for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Now.
And you can see that operating in hate groups.
There's also an attentional bias, which is the fact that A cognitive bias, one of dozens, is called attentional bias, and we have our perceptions are influenced by our own recurring thoughts. So if I keep on thinking the same thing over and over again, I am reinforcing my own thoughts, and that's an attribution. Because I've had that in my head so long, I'm not going to remember actually where it came from, but I'm going to, oh, I've been thinking that for a million years, that must be true. I'm not even going to evaluate it again because I must have already evaluated this. So I'm just going to automatically attribute my thought to, you know, what's going on out there in the real world.
Is that, do you think that's why we have so much, you know, people tuning in to a particular, let's say, television news station that has a bias that they have because it's reinforcing what, and they don't want to know. They don't even want to go to that other station.
Well, actually, that's true. That's another cognitive bias that we have. It's called the illusion of truth effect, which means that people are more likely to believe a familiar statement than an unfamiliar one. Mm.
Right.
And so, again, because of hyperbolic discounting, why do I want to get something that is going to be at odds with what I'm already believing? I don't want to have to deal with that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's self-reinforcing.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, it also goes back to what we've talked about before, how many times you are so sure you're right about something, totally convinced, and then when the evidence is put before you, it's shocking. You can't believe that you were wrong.
How did I miss this? Yeah.
How did I miss this? Right.
Well, then what people do in that case, many people just discount the new evidence.
Mm. No, that's right.
This evidence. So there's something called cryptoamnesia or a false memory, which is a form of a cognitive bias or misattribution where a memory is mistaken for imagination. So if we get some new evidence presented to us, you know, and we may think, oh, I imagined that. It's not real.
Yeah.
No, I don't have any exposure to that in the past. So, but it's very common. You know, years ago, people might remember the false memory syndrome. That's where a lot of these research came into, where a lot of these cognitive biases were identified back then. Mm-hmm. So they're insidious. They happen all the time.
Yeah. Just to show that these cognitive phenomena that we're talking about are real and biological, we were talking earlier about dehumanization. There's been some neuroscience research that shows when somebody is actually dehumanizing someone, and they're under a brain scan, the parts of the brain that are associated with disgust get turned on, get lit up. And the parts of the brain that are associated with empathy get turned off. So the modules of the biological modules, more or less, that get turned on and off according to what the cognition is. So we're not just talking about something ephemeral or, you know, loosey-goosey psychobabble. This is a real phenomenon.
It's real. And let me tell you, I can speak from experience with other people who do family therapy. We know from research that once a person gets to the point of being disgusted with something, another person's behavior, an event, or food, something like that, disgust is such a turnoff that it's done.
Mm-hmm.
It destroys the relationship.
You can't turn it back.
You cannot go back after
disgust.
No, and
it's a primitive emotion that goes back in evolution millions of
years. Very powerful.
Disgust has a survival benefit in terms of you're disgusted by an odor, so you don't eat that food. Or you're disgusted by a scene, you avoid it because it can be dangerous. So it's a very primitive emotion. So is empathy. Empathy is primitive because it allows us to support one another and survive as a group.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the empathy thing. So if you're turning off empathy parts in your brain, how do we turn that back on? I mean, is that something that can be turned back on when you are presented with, you know, the other person's position or thoughts or, you know, understanding? I mean,
well,
can you do
that?
It
won't be turned back on with other evidence like we've been talking about. It has to be turned back on with other experiences of closeness and safety and security and a validation. That's how it has to be turned back on. And you can't just flick a switch.
Right.
It's an experiential thing. And that's why psychotherapy works.
Mm-hmm. Right. There was some research on changing people's biases and through a lot of what they called incentives, nudges, and retraining, their cognitive biases were able to be trained and not totally trained away but modified, but only a few of them, such as anchoring, bias about the blind spot could be changed, confirmation bias, fundamental attribution, many of the things we're talking about, those simple biases can be changed. But even those things, it takes training and exposure and practice, not just something, that's wrong, forget about it, read this article. Right. Much more complex than that. It's not as easy to change someone's biases as you might think, as it takes a lot of exposure and deliberate training and education.
We kind of keep hearing education, mm-hmm. which I guess is really important. But I'm just thinking, Mark, you said something earlier about we're going to see a lot more of these hate groups popping up or extreme groups. And so I'm sure people go, what can we do? How do we combat this growing?
Well, bear in mind that we talk about education, confirmation bias, all this kind of stuff. The hate groups are doing the same thing. They're educating mm-hmm. people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're taking the same kind of techniques that we're talking about using for a beneficial result and using it for a maladaptive kind of result, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. So they are using the same kind of techniques that have to be used to try and get people away from them. Basically, it's like the de-brainwashing that the people have to engage in to get someone removed from a cult.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And when a cult gets to be too bad, they're going to do a Jim Jones and have everyone kill themselves
right.
because that cult leader does not want to have his power diluted.
Right.
It takes a lot of psychological strength to share power with someone yeah. else. You know?
I was going to say, when you talk to anybody who's been in a cult and once they're on the outside, you can see how difficult it was for them to get away. It's pretty much they cut ties with anybody on the outside who may
Correct.
Try
it's
to
like
convince
starting
you
the
that
life over again.
Yeah. It's I would imagine a very emotional.
It reminds
thing.
Me, Mindy, you found a video online mm-hmm. that explained racism from a new angle that I hadn't considered. And really what when we're trying to overcome racism, we're trying to overcome, at least in this country, over 400 years of a practice, of a psychological practice. And it was based on the history that when the Europeans came to this continent, they conquered everybody, killed everybody. They had bigger guns. They had guns. They also brought some germs that were foreign, and that helped. But they had steel in the form of weapons. So that led to the belief that these other races, darker skin usually, were less evolved, less
less
good.
Human.
They were inferior in
they
some
were
way,
inferior.
Is what they thought. Yeah,
yes, because the whites were always able to conquer mm-hmm. them. So we must be better. Mm-hmm. So that's where the some dehumanization started and has just continued mm-hmm. Throughout our history. Mm-hmm. So when we're talking about trying to combat racism, we're talking about trying to combat something that we've been practicing in the United States for over 400 years.
Right.
And we came by, we didn't cause this in our generation, but we've inherited it.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's
a powerful.
On the list of cognitive biases, we would call that institutional bias, that the mm-hmm. institution is always right.
Yes.
Power is correct.
Exactly.
The man is always right. Institutional mm-hmm. bias, that's like a default switch that Mark's talking
that's
about.
Right.
We've inherited that belief.
Right.
You know, the Europeans were white. They had the power. These people didn't have anything. So obviously, we must be better and more powerful. And that's certainly institutional bias that we still have today.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So how do you combat that?
Well, at the 30 seconds, so how much time do we have to do?
Well, we've been about a couple
it's
minutes.
Extremely difficult to overcome institutional bias, but the first thing you have to remember is that people have to want to overcome it. Okay, you can't have to want another person to overcome it. You have to want to overcome it on your own. And the people we're talking about, hate groups and out groups, they really don't want to overcome it. They mm-hmm. want to have other people believe what they believe, irrespective, except they only want certain people. They want the attractive people, people who are attractive to their movement. They don't want any of the out groups to become a part of them. They don't want them to join, mm-hmm. you know. So the way you'd have to do this, start, first of all, with the desire to change and the self-awareness of need to change. And there are a lot of different training techniques that you could use to do that. But those are the two basic things.
Well, ideally, you'd be able to provide them some experiences of effectiveness and power, which are not based on hate and which are not based on domination, but are based on some kind of cooperation, mutuality.
I'm not really sure.
That would be the ideal method.
I'm not sure that changes an entire group, because people will always say, well, some of my best friends are African American, some of my best, you know, mm-hmm. and they do have friends who are in that
sure.
group, but the greater class, you know, their attitudes toward that greater class of race doesn't change, but they do have people in outgroups that they do like and they do
sure.
business with and they have friends
mm-hmm.
with. So mm-hmm. it really is more of just the exposure and the introduction of individuals that doesn't make people change their viewpoint about the entire race. It's very puzzling, but what's the old saying? You know, one swallow doesn't make a summer. So you may have a good experience with one person, but
right.
that they, a lot of people will not generalize that to an entire group. So, that's just that one person.
Right.
So
right.
it's tricky.
I never heard that before. One swallow does not make a summer. I can remember that. All right. Psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Mark Whaley, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you next month.
Very good.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Okay.